Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History Dweebs. I am Tim, and we'd like to welcome you to our podcast today. Thank you for joining us. I'm joined, as always, by the lovely blue hair beauty, Brandy. How are you today, Brandy?
I'm good, Tim. How are you?
Outstanding.
Great.
Now, the Colonel couldn't be with us today because he is out on the campaign trail. You know, he's out in Iowa. But we are joined by Chuck, and we are happy to have you today, Chuck, to talk about this very important topic. How are you today, Chuck?
I am doing good, Timmy. I know these are big, big boots to fill with the colonels. I'm going to do the best I can here.
Yeah, he has big boots. Okay, so the topic today is a little bit different, a little bit more serious topic. We're going to go back to a day that really changed everything and changed the world that we live in today. Chuck, if I ask you, who is the most important person who's lived in the last 100 years? What kind of names do you think you hear? If you ask a person on the street.
Yeah, ask a person. You're probably going to hear, in the last 100 years, you're going to hear, well, that's Lincoln goes back further than that, but
Churchill.
Churchill, FDR. I'd say, to me, probably in our country, the most influential is FDR, possibly Reagan.
Right. But that was being the names that most people would not recognize the name of Gavrilo Princip. But yet, I think you can make an argument that Gavrilo Princip has had more influence on the world we live in today than anyone who's lived in the last 100 years. I think of these time-lapse photos where you kind of go through time. And say you start today and you start with ISIS, and then you go back in your mind, you see a photo of ISIS and the beheadings, and then you see the 9/11 attacks and the Afghan war, and then you go back a little further, you see the Iraq War 1 and 2, Vietnam, the Cold War, the Korean War, Joseph Stalin ruling over Russia and killing, 20 to 50 million Russians, the whole World War II and Hitler and the Holocaust, the Communist Revolution, and even World War I, and even the spread of the Spanish flu could all be traced, and an argument can be made that this all could be traced back to one day in 1914, June 28, 1914, in a town, in a city called Sarajevo, which is in Bosnia and in the Balkans in Europe. And at that time, the events of that day led to the world that we live in. And what happened that day is going to be the topic of our discussion. Now, to understand this, to get some background, there's two principles involved in this story. One is Gavrilo Princip, which is who was essentially a nobody until that day, And the other one is the was a member of the Austrian-Hungary royal family, the heir to the Austrian-Hungarian throne. Austrian-Hungary, of course, a country in Central Europe that no longer exists, but did back in 1914. And the heir to the throne was a guy by the name of Franz Ferdinand, who was kind of played the role that Prince Charles plays today. Although, unlike Prince Charles, he would have, if he had succeeded to the throne, he would have had real power over the Austrian-Hungary nation. And Austria-Hungary at the time was the overlords of Bosnia, and that is where Gavrilo Princip lived. And a lot of the Bosnians did not want to be a part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. They wanted to be a part of a larger Serbian or Slavic nation that would include Bosnia and Serbia and Herzegovina. And Gavrilo Princip was a young man at the time. He was only 20 years old at the time of our story. And they were trying to make a statement to the Austrian-Hungarian throne, a statement to say, hey, we want our independence. So, Chuck, tell us a little bit about, first of all, about Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Well, you know, and here's the thing to me, there's nothing... You know, is when you go back to the royal families and things like that throughout Europe, throughout that time, there's really nothing that is that exceptional about the guy. You know, I mean, that's the whole story to this is you have two really unexceptionable people who created this dramatic change in the world. So a little bit about him. The Archduke was born in 1863. And it's kind of almost like a comedy of errors. I mean,
this whole story is just like almost a fluke.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, hitting the lottery. He would have never been Archduke.
An heir to the throne.
He was born in 1863. Now, in 1899, his cousin, Crown Prince Rudolf, commits suicide.
And Rudolf was in line.
He was in direct line for the throne. Now, this left Franz Ferdinand's father, Karl, as first in line to the throne. But then his dad died 7 years later of typhoid. So now Franz Ferdinand, who has no, you know, when he was born...
The chances of him ascending to the throne was very...
Now, the only... Now, he was one of the wealthiest men, had he not even been, you know, on the throne, he was one of the wealthiest men in Austria. When he was 11, his cousin, Duke Francis, died. And he named Franz Ferdinand his heir on the condition that he just add the name Este to his own. I mean, so it made
him deal.
Yeah, made him one of the wealthiest men there. He was a pretty passionate guy. And here's something else. Now, you've got him not being in line for the throne at all.
Right.
Okay? Not being in line for the throne at all. And then the guy kills himself. Then his dad dies. Now, he's out hunting. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to up to 1913. He's on the throne at this time. He was a big trophy hunter. Mm-hmm. Loved to hunt. And one of the loaders fell. And the loaders were the guys who carried the guns and did everything else. And this guy had a double-barrel shotgun. The loader falls. There's two guys, the Archduke and I forget who was with him. Walking ahead of the loader. The damn double-barrel shotgun goes off. Both barrels. And the shells go right between them, right between the two.
Misses them.
By rights, he should have been dead that day. Now, if he's dead, he's never on the throne.
Yeah,
he doesn't get shot. Nothing happens.
Right. He's not. He wouldn't be an heir.
Yeah. Now he, you know, like all Austrians, you know, he spent his time in the military.
He didn't. But there's nothing now. Now here's kind of the strange thing, you know. The irony to this is, he had a much different view. He believed that the countries that they controlled should have more autonomy.
Yeah.
He was actually fairly liberal. He was going to give them more autonomy. The Serbs would have been better off with him in power.
Yeah, and his uncle at the time was on the throne, Franz Joseph, who was elderly man. He was in his late 70s, I think.
And, yeah, so they're just waiting for Franz Joseph to die.
Yeah, basically.
And he's going to take the throne.
And he's going to give them autonomy, or at least he's going to be more sympathetic to the Serbs having autonomy than anyone who preceded him.
Right. And they would have been, you know, the way they describe it, he wanted to take a very, very careful approach toward Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, if harsh treatment of Serbia is going to bring Austria-Hungary, this was his belief, if you treat Serbia harshly, you're going to run into an open conflict with Russia. Now, an open conflict with Russia, he believed, was going to be the ruin, the downfall of both empires, the Austria-Hungary empire and the Russian empire.
Yeah, and there was this whole complex series of treaties between all these powers. Today, we think of the United States as being a superpower.
Right.
In those days, in the early 20th century, there were multiple superpowers. You had the Russian emergence as being a country emerging as a superpower. You had Germany, a new superpower. Great Britain was, of course, an empire, a superpower, as was France. So you had a lot of different. You had the Ottoman Empire in the middle of Turkish. So you had a lot of superpowers. Today, you know, we think of, really, when we grew up as kids, you had two superpowers, United States and Soviet Union. Basically, today, we're the only superpower. But in those days, the world was made up of many different superpowers. And his fear was that if they got drawn into a conflict with Serbia, that the treaty that Serbia had with Russia would kick in, and that would be the end of Austria-Hungary. And really, in the end, he was right.
Yeah. Now, the only group that he didn't really like, he did not like the Hungarians. I mean, he had an extreme dislike and distrust of Hungary. He thought Hungarian nationalism was the biggest threat to the Habsburg dynasty. That's the only, you know, typically he was liberal. He was fairly patient, fairly tolerant, until it came to Hungary. But, you know, again, that's just a little fact. Mm-hmm. In the bigger picture of things, he was not, there was nothing that stood out. There was nothing special about this guy. He wasn't going to change it. He may have changed history a little bit because he believed that Austria-Hungary needed a navy. He was a big supporter of really building up the navy. He thought that that's something they didn't have. And when the war started, you know, the Great War,
mm-hmm.
they really had no navy to speak of, and it really put them in a bad spot.
Yeah,
that may have changed something. But again, there's nothing you can say about this guy that makes him remarkable.
The one thing, I guess, that stood out for me, he kind of married out of his class.
Yeah.
He married Sophie. Duchess Sophie, who wasn't really accepted by the aristocratic.
Yeah, and most of them didn't come to the wedding.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't even come to the wedding. It was back in that day, you know, we all remember the Princess Di Charles wedding. Mm-hmm. Back in that day, all the royal weddings were like that. I mean, a royal mm-hmm. wedding was a big deal. And his was basically skipped by most of the European royalty because he was marrying what was considered a lower class, someone below his social status.
But they were married, and they had kids, and she joined Franz Ferdinand on his trip to Sarajevo in June of 1914. So that's the background on Archduke Ferdinand. He basically he represented the Austrian-Hungary Empire. He was the heir to the throne. But as Chuck said, really he was just your average member of the royal family, other than.
But and he was again very leery of war.
Mm-hmm.
He was smart enough, and his father was smart enough to know the entanglements of the treaties that were all going on, and he kind of knew that a conflict with Russia
mm-hmm.
was going to start these things in motion. Uh-huh. That he had very little control of, and he truly believed that it was going to be the end of the Habsburg dynasty. It would be the end of the Russian Empire. The end of, so he would have been, he understood that, and that would have been a time of, I think, probably relative peace,
mm-hmm.
because he was, they were a power then.
Yeah, they were a player then, and they had this strong alliance with Germany, who was also an emerging power. But there were a lot of folks in Austria-Hungary that wanted to deal with the Serbian question and Bosnian question, and he was not one of them. He wanted to kind of work things out peacefully.
Basically, he wanted to be in, and basically he viewed it as, and again, he didn't like the Hungarians much
mm-hmm.
because he thought the Hungarians were far too nationalistic. The Serbians, he actually felt a little bit of sympathy for him, mm-hmm. and he felt like, you know what?
And they had not been a part.
Keep them in the dynasty, mm-hmm. keep them under our umbrella, but give them some autonomy. Don't push things.
And they had not been a part of the Austrian-Hungary Empire for that long. They had been earlier. They had been part of the Turkish Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's kind of the background on Archduke Ferdinand. So him and his wife decide to go to Sarajevo. Now this is where our story picks up with Gavrilo Princip. Gavrilo Princip is. If there could be, kind of the total opposite of Franz Ferdinand, it would be Gavrilo Princip. Princip was born on July 25th, 1894 in Bosnia. He was one of nine children, six of whom died in infancy. He lived in a poor family. His family worked. Were poor farmers who worked the land for the landlords that day. So they were kind of like, I guess, sharecroppers. They were considered serfs. And I mean, this was 20th century, and you're still talking about serfs. In fact, when he was arrested, one of the forms that the police used when they arrested Gavrilo Princip. Where they're collecting the demographic information, one of the questions you can still see today asks to whom does this serf belong? So, I mean, this wasn't that long ago. You're talking, serfdom here. But Princip went to school. He started going to school, primary school, in 1903 at the age of nine. And he was pretty successful in his studies. And at age 13, Princip moved to the city of Sarajevo to study to move in with his older brother. And he intended to enroll, ironically enough, into the Austrian-Hungary military school there in Sarajevo. But his brother discouraged him from joining the Austrian-Hungary military school. Telling him he didn't want to, don't be an executioner of your own people. So this is where kind of Princip's earlier years, where he starts to kind of get radicalized to the Serbian cause. So he enrolled in a merchant school instead. And in 1911, at the age of 17, Princip joined an organization called Young Bosnia. And it was a society that wanted to separate Bosnia from Austria-Hungary and unite it with the Kingdom of Serbia, which was next door, which was also home of Slavs. But because local authorities had forbidden students to forming organizations and clubs that sought a separate Bosnia, this group, the Young Bosnians, had to meet in secret. In 1912, though, Princip was expelled from school for being involved in a demonstration against the Austrian-Hungary authorities. He left Sarajevo after being expelled, and he walked 170 miles on foot to Belgrade to fight in Serbia. Serbia at the time was in a fight with the Ottoman Turks, who were kind of their overlords, and he wanted to join up. But he was turned down because he was too, they said he was too small of stature and too weak. Which really discouraged him. He actually found the leader of this organization, the Young Bosnians, and went to them to demand that he be allowed to join in his struggle against the Ottoman Empire and fight for Serbia. And the leader told him the same thing, that he was too small and he's too weak to fight. So this kind of discouraged him, but he did join an organization called the Serbian Chetnik Organization, and it was a terrorist organization. We would call today a terrorist organization. They trained young men to on military training, paramilitary training. They taught them how to shoot, how to use bombs, how to use knives. And in their struggle against, Austria-Hungary and the Ottoman Empire. So he learned these trades with other young men, and it was then that he was going through this training that on June 28, 1914, that the Archduke Franz Ferdinand visited Sarajevo. So Princip was with a group of young men who decided to make a statement and assassinate the Austrian Archduke when he arrived in Sarajevo. So this was a true conspiracy. There were seven of them. And the Archduke arrived on June 28, 1914 by train.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It was a Sunday. He and the Duchess arrived, and they got in. They got in an open car. Some of this sounds eerily like Dallas in 1963. The parade route was listed in the newspaper. So the royal couple are driving in an open car, and along the route were seven of these conspirators, including Gabriel Princip. And the plan was, again, to make a statement against Austria-Hungary by killing the heir to the Austrian-Hungary throne. Well, the motorcade went by. The first conspirator, he kind of lost his nerve, and the car passed, and he didn't take any action. At 10:15 a.m., this was a six-car procession, was rolling down the street past the Central Police Station. That's when a second conspirator got involved, and he did take action. He threw a bomb, which I guess today we would consider more like a hand grenade, at the Archduke's car. It bounced off the Archduke's car and exploded, and it killed members of or injured folks in the car following the Archduke's car. So it didn't hurt the Archduke and the Duchess. But it did go off, and it caused, you know, it was chaos. It was blood in the streets, and it was this big panic during this big parade procession. Two of the occupants of the car were seriously wounded, along with a dozen spectators. So this was their shot, right? So five of the conspirators, including Princip, thought they lost this opportunity to kill the Archduke, because this bomb went off and, you know, they blew it. They killed the injured folks in the following car. Now, the guy who threw the bomb, he took a cyanide capsule and jumped in the river to kill himself. Unfortunately, the cyanide capsule had expired.
There you go.
And he just got sick, and the river was only 10 inches deep.
Was not well thought through.
You know, and think about, had the guy just dove in head first, he might have broken his neck.
Yeah.
But what you got is a bad cyanide capsule.
Yeah, he made himself sick.
Yeah, made it just get put him in a more foul mood.
Was it Rasputin?
Exactly. This guy's like Rasputin.
Yeah.
And then he goes and tries to drown in. I've got a creek by my house that's deeper than that.
Yeah, 10 inches is not very deep. I'm not, you know, and you think they would have thought it through a little bit more. But anyway, they lost their shot. So kind of, you know, feeling disheartened, and the five conspirators just go their separate ways, and Princip decides he's just going to go away. Now, there's a story that Princip goes and has a sandwich, and this story is so odd. That's what everyone takes away from this story. It seems like, oh, he just gave up and went to
McDonald's and
saw
the Archduke coming through the drive-thru.
And I was, you know, researching this story, and this historian in Australia has been researching this fact. He was a history teacher, and he says all of his kids always remember his damn sandwich.
Yeah.
And he went back to try to find where the source of this came from. Now, these events that we'll talk about soon took place outside of a deli, so that's kind of, I guess, where this connection is made. But there is no historical evidence that Princip ever went to eat a sandwich after this. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. No one knows for sure, but the furthest he could go back on this story was 1998, so yeah. I don't think it's,
But he was at the deli.
He was outside the deli. So, but anyway, they go their separate ways. Franz Ferdinand, he goes on to his festivities that were scheduled. You know, the mayor meets him, and, you know, the mayor is giving his, you know, prepared speech. Welcome to Sarajevo. Yeah. And Franz Ferdinand's a little pissed off at this point, saying, you know, is this how you welcome your guests? You throw bombs at them.
And things have changed, but, the world's changed. But think about President Obama. Mm-hmm. Okay. He's driving down the street. Somebody throws a bomb at his car.
Right.
What is going to happen?
He's going to be in a bunker in about
five minutes. They're going to have him, the vice president, the speaker at Boehner.
Right.
Literally, they're going to have the Secret Service surrounding these guys until they figure out what the hell happened.
Right.
They're not just going to say, well, you know, it was a little bomb and it missed. Don't worry, president.
Right.
You're all good. Just keep going.
You're all good, you know, because the ladies' Iowa Chamber of Commerce or whatever.
Right.
You know, go ahead and make the speech.
Yeah, go ahead and make your speech. No one let it interrupt your schedule.
Yeah.
So the Archduke, you know, goes through the festivity as planned, and then kind of in a courageous move decides he's going to go and visit the people who were injured in the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, that certainly wouldn't happen today.
It might happen today, but he would have an army with him.
Exactly.
This guy had, what do you have, three guys
with him? And they and he was still in an open car.
Well, and he had, you know, basically Fredo from The Godfather driving. You know what I mean?
Right. So the Duke, the Archduke Ferdinand decides he wants him and his wife decide to go check out on their party in the hospital who were injured, and so they decide to take a different route. The head of security suggests wisely to take a different route, but they forgot to tell the driver, and the driver is taking the same route that they came in on, which is, you know, was lined with assassins, right? So they're driving, and then finally someone says, they pull in, I love this, this is the most ironic part of the whole thing. On their way to the hospital, the car, the driver pulls, turns right on Franz Joseph Street.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, of course, the Archduke's uncle's name. Pulls in on Franz Joseph Street. When they finally talk, you know, say, hey, wait a minute, you're going the wrong way. Now, this was 1914, and you know, automobiles were, you know, a new thing back then.
They had GPS,
right? And transmissions were not, you know, there were some issues with them. So the guy, the driver, stops and with an intention of backing up and, you know, turning around, and the car stalls. Well, just so happens,
yeah,
walking by is guess who? Gabriel Prince.
Yeah, Prince.
Right? Here's the
guy. Soaking wet and got an upset stomach.
No. That was the first assassin.
Yeah.
But it was Prince. He had, you know, well, whether or not he had a sandwich or not, we don't know. But he was in front of a place called Moritz's Schiller's Cafe. And here he is, you know, 3 feet away from Archduke Ferdinand's car.
And I'm picturing the guy just standing at the counter saying,
man.
Hey, can you make that to go?
Hurry up, make that to go. So, you know, the driver's trying to reverse the car. Franz Ferdinand and his wife is in the back seat, open car. You know, Princip just reacts. He pulls out his pistol, fires two shots. The first one hits the Duchess, Sophie. And the second one hits Franz Ferdinand in the neck through the jugular, and he dies. Sophie dies.
And, you know, and truly, you know, here's kind of another ironic part of this is that Sophie's seen him coming.
Mm-hmm.
Sophie's seen him point the gun, and Sophie
tried to
with
protect.
The Secret Service. She threw herself over the Duchess. She takes one in the stomach.
Exactly.
Now he's covered up,
mm-hmm.
fires another shot. Now, you know, and I believe he shot him with a .38.
Yeah, I don't know what the.
So she took one for the team.
She takes one.
She tried to protect him.
She's laying over the top, so the guy can't be that exposed. He hit him in the damn neck.
And on the in the jugular.
In the jugular. Now, I go to the target range all the time. From here to that wall, I don't know that I could hit somebody in the neck with an old .38.
Yeah, and you got in these guns at the time couldn't be the most accurate thing.
Exactly.
And he was, I mean, you know, when you think about how young he was 19 years old at the time.
Yeah, he couldn't have been, you know.
It was just one of those, you know, one of the oddest, you know, if you wrote a story, no one would believe it. But here, you know, he's just walking down the street.
It's almost like a Monty Python scene.
Yeah, it really is.
It reminds me of the Pink Panther.
Yeah.
And the police chief, the camp commander that couldn't shoot off shot off his nose.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, all these, I mean, there's just a whole calamity.
Yeah, a whole, like Chuck said, a whole comedy of errors that took place, and yet it had such a, you know, devastating effect on the world. And so Princip, he grabs his cyanide. They all had cyanide.
Yeah.
And, of course, it
didn't work.
He just vomited. And, you know, you got to look at those dates on them.
You really do. You need to update your cyanide every month.
Cyanide inventory every mm-hmm. once in a while. The pistol was grabbed from him. He tried to shoot himself. The pistol was grabbed from him. He couldn't fire another shot. And he was arrested. He was 19 at the time. And he was arrested.
Yes, he was arrested. And so he was 19 years old. He was too young to receive the death penalty. And he was...
He was like what? Like 20...
He was 27 days short of his the 20-year minimum.
You know, I think they would have waived that rule here. Yeah,
and
I
kind of find it for the time is very interesting.
It's progressive.
Because how they, you know... They were hanging 14-year-olds.
Well, I mean, and you
blame them?
When you think that, think that 17 million people are going to die directly.
Yeah, exactly.
As a risk, and to be fair to Princip, had he known what the?
But you know, he was an anarchist. He really didn't.
Yeah, I mean,
he was 19. He wouldn't have cared. He would have thought, maybe. You know, this was.
No, he couldn't see 2 feet in front of his face. So anyway, I saw well enough to shoot the guy in the neck, I suppose. But he received the maximum sentence of 20 years in prison. He was held in really harsh conditions, and they were made worse by the war. Which war was that?
Which he started. Which he started. Because what happened after this assassination, of course, the Austrian-Hungary, you know, they were pissed. And they blamed they didn't think this was a, you know, obviously it was a conspiracy. There were 7 people involved, and they had ties to this group called the Young Bosnians and another group called the Black Hand.
Black Hand, yeah.
And so Austria-Hungary gave Serbia, they blamed us all in Serbia and gave them a list of demands, ultimatum. Serbia couldn't meet those demands or wouldn't meet those demands. And
I don't have the demands in front of me.
They meant like 9 out of the 10. The one they couldn't.
But there was one they absolutely could not meet.
Sovereignty. It was the Austrian-Hungary authorities wanted to become investigate in Serbia. And Serbia thought, you know, that was a violation of their sovereignty, and they would not allow that. But basically, Austria-Hungary set the bar so high, that no country.
Basically, what Austria was doing here is they're saying, okay, we want to solve this peacefully, but they're setting up terms that they know that they can't meet.
Yes.
What Austria-Hungary wanted to do was crush Serbia.
Yes.
They wanted revenge, and they wanted to crush Serbia, but they didn't want to appear.
Yeah. You said, they were also concerned about Russia getting in the game.
Yeah.
So Austria-Hungary, Franz Josef reaches out to Germany to say, hey, you got our back if we go in. This Kaiser Wilhelm says, yeah, we got your back if it, you know, push comes to shove. So that the war starts. So Austria-Hungary attacks Belgrade, and then Russia mobilizes in defense of to defend the Serbs. Germany, seeing that Russia is mobilizing, begins to mobilize against Russia. In Germany's situation, they feared a two-front war with Russia and France. So they had this plan. The military had devised for years that should this situation occur, where they were first going to neutralize France and then turn their attention to Russia. Well, Russia would take weeks to mobilize, and by that time, Germany thought they could go in and neutralize France and then turn their attention eastward. To make that plan work, though, they had to go through neutral Belgium. So they attacked France through neutral Belgium. Well, Great Britain had a treaty with Belgium. They didn't have one with France, but they had a treaty with Belgium. And when Germany attacked, went through Belgium to reach France, Great Britain declared war on Germany. And then that's how you get to World War I. And it left 17 million people dead. It led to the Treaty of Versailles, which, of course, put harsh conditions on the defeated powers, especially Germany. Austria-Hungary was just broken up, but Germany received harsh reparations. And of course, that led to economic insecurity in Germany and the rise of Adolf Hitler in World War II. So, Treaty of Versailles also led to the breaking up of the Ottoman Empire, which was the most of the Middle East. And when they created the new borders of the Middle East, they did it based on geography, not based upon the different sects. So you had Shia and you had Kurds and you had Sunnis that were all thrown in together in these new borders. And that's why you have, you know, the trouble we've had in the Middle East for years and still have today. Of course, the First World War also saw Russia, conditions in Russia deteriorate. That led to the Bolshevik Revolution and communism in Russia, and it spread through, of course, to China, and then you know led to the whole Cold War. So all of this can be traced back to this June day back in 1914, when Gabriel Princip fired two shots and killed Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Duchess Sophie. And Brandy's going to tell us what happened to Princip.
He contracted tuberculosis
while in jail.
While in prison, yeah. And he died April 28th, 1918. He'd been in prison 3 years and 10 months after he assassinated the Archduke and the Duchess. At the time of his death, he was weakened by malnutrition and disease and weighed about 88 pounds. His body had become racked by skeletal tuberculosis that ate away at his bones so badly that his right arm had to be amputated. When he died, the jailers felt like his bones might become relics for Slav nationalists, so they took the body to a secret unmarked grave to bury it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a Czech soldier that was assigned to the burial that remembered the location, and in 1920, Princip and some of the other heroes of the Vidovdan were disinterred, and they were brought back to Sarajevo, where they were buried together beneath a chapel. The chapel was built to commemorate for eternity our Serb heroes.
Yeah, you know, Princip is now, you know, he's still considered a hero in Bosnia, and they have a plaque where he actually, you know, where the assassination took place.
Well, and this is what's screwy. So the house where he lived in Sarajevo was destroyed during World War I.
Princip's house,
okay. Yes. After the war, it was rebuilt as a museum in the Kingdom of Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was conquered by Germany in 1941, and Sarajevo became part of the independent state of Croatia. The Croatian state destroyed the house again. After the establishment of communist Yugoslavia in 1944, the house became a museum again, and then there was another museum dedicated to him within the city of Sarajevo. But during the Yugoslav Wars of the 1990s, the house was destroyed again.
A third time.
It was a third time. They have not rebuilt it yet.
It's like, okay, this
yeah, just
is
forget
enough.
It.
Yeah, forget it. Okay,
it's
we're
enough.
Good.
Yeah, there's a plaque in front of the museum at the spot where Princip stood, and he stood and fired his shots. The pistol that he used was confiscated by authorities and eventually given, along with the Archduke's bloody undershirt, to a Jesuit priest who was a close friend of the Archduke and had given him and the Duchess their last rites. The pistol and the shirt remained in with the Jesuits until they were offered on a long-term loan to the Museum of Military History in Vienna in 2004. And today, it's part of a permanent exhibition there.
Yeah, you can go there. I mean, you don't have to go to Vienna. You can go online. You can see the car that the Archduke and the Duchess were riding in. You can see the tunic that the Archduke was wearing. It's very bright blue tunic. And you can even, if you look closely enough, you can even see, like, the blood stains from where he was bleeding mm-hmm. and the hole that the bullet made. It's be a cool thing to see, but you know, it's just like Chuck was saying, a comedy of errors that led what a different. It's like alternate history. It'd be fun to say, well, what if that day didn't happen, or what if that. You know, what if...
What if he hadn't stopped for a sandwich?
What if he hadn't stopped for a sandwich? Or what if he, you know, what if the Archduke had just not went to Sarajevo? Or, you know, you could, how the world would be different. But that's the story of Sarajevo in June of 1914. Any final thoughts for you, Brandy?
No.
Okay. Where should people look for our podcast?
Well, you can find us on Stitcher and iTunes and on our History Dweebs webpage.
And Facebook. And if you go to iTunes,
please leave a review. That's how people find us.
Yes. Thank you all very much, and we'll see you again real soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.